Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The Double X Gab Fest is sponsored by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audiblepodcast.com/XX.
Welcome to the Double X Gab Fest, the old sperm edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, editor of Double X. I'm joined, rare treat, in the DC studio by Noreen Malone, who's a writer for The New Republic. Hello, Noreen.
Hey, Hannah.
And Allison Benedict, lonely in New York, the other Double X editor. Hi, Allison.
Hey, guys.
Our topics for today are, first is, should we really be waiting to have babies until our 40s? The second is the new explosion of gender-neutral toys. And the third is a new study confirming our fears that women never ask men to marry them. And why? Why is that? So let's start with our first topic about babies. Judith Shulevitz, who is a wonderful writer for The New Republic, takes on this phenomenon that we all know is happening but haven't really taken account of. What does it mean that women and men are having children at older ages? This is, of course, a natural consequence of feminism, of the idea that women's choices should be as little constrained as possible. But it turns out that the experts are a lot more worried about this than we are, that they are showing an uptick in kids with birth defects, down, sensory issues, ADHD, autism. And we haven't even gotten to the social questions, which Allison takes on in a post this week, having to take care of our toddlers and our own parents at the same time and becoming grandparents ourselves at such a late age. So, Allison, you wrote this week that you regretted it? How do I characterize what you wrote? Would you call it regret or just contemplation? Or what's your feeling about waiting to have children as you are now pregnant? And I don't know how old you are, but, you know,
I think
older than you should be, surely.
I'm 35. And so actually, as you know, in the reactions to these, I'm 35 and I'm having my third kid. So a lot of people wrote to me saying, like, how old do you think you should be when you're having your third kid? And I was talking in my post specifically about me, but also just kind of more generally, because I think I'm probably on the younger end of old. Mm-hmm. But I, not regret, contemplation, I think. It's something that, setting aside all of the kind of scary medical stuff that Judith goes into her piece in such detailed manner, what you said, the social aspects of it, I don't think many of us consider when we're in our mid and late 20s. And, you know, I was married at 26, so I could have started earlier. And a lot of people have written to me saying, well, that's nice for you. You had the choice and you decided to wait and that's your own fault. But I haven't found someone yet and I'm 30. And people took this as me being very judgmental about the decision to wait. But that's really not what I mean. But I think as it's become a lot more acceptable, which is great, to kind of make these life choices later in life, including looking for a mate later in life, because I think the reason often we are all finding mates later is because that's become the norm, not just because we can't find them. There are consequences, and it's ridiculous to think that there aren't. I guess it's choosing between your two selves. It's choosing between a certain space to grow in and relate to your family members in a certain way in your 20s and 30s versus in your 60s and 70s. The thought of being, you know, being on sort of grandparent duty at 80, coming to my son's, you know, first labor, you know, my son's wife's first labor and supposed to be helping out and cooking and doing everything when I'm 80 years old, that sounds not great to me.
But it's the problem is that we don't actually think about it, right?
Right.
That we don't actually consider these things when we're getting into it, that we're just living in an era of feminism when we think of these things as entirely a choice, and we don't spend so much time thinking about the consequences of that choice. Or is that true? This is such a touchy subject. It's so hard for women to think about constraints, especially constraints in their 20s and early 30s. I keep waiting, and I'm posing this to Noreen now, for this to switch. People keep telling me, oh, but the younger generation is finally recognizing this. Like, we're finally reckoning with the later years fertility problems. But is that really true? I mean, I just don't really see where we could go now. Could we really go backwards?
I think people are highly aware of it. I don't think that people my age and younger are thinking that we have forever to have kids. I think stuff like this has been coming. You know, Judith's article was probably the most comprehensive and the most damning case against having kids later. But New York Magazine last year had an article about it. I've read there was a recent New Girl episode where they freak out about their fertility at age 30. Right. Like, it's in the air. The younger women are thinking about it.
But don't you think a lot of people take that stuff as fear mongering instead of like legitimate?
Yeah, I know. I think people are, as you said, unwilling to sort of think that they cannot be an exception, right? You never want to think that your eggs are going to be the ones, or your husband's sperm or your partner's sperm is going to be, you know, the unfortunate set. But what struck me about your post, Allison, was the economics of it, right? So maybe, I don't know if this is the case, but in theory, maybe one of the reasons you waited was to wait until you and your husband were more ready financially to have kids, right? And especially for people in this younger age group who aren't getting great jobs out of college, I think that is a real concern, even if they did want to have kids at 25, you know, they don't feel on solid enough footing.
But isn't that part of the same phenomenon? Like,
yes.
It didn't used to be that people, I mean, Jess Gross used to talk about this, how her parents were, or, you know, Mitt and Ann Romney, like, they're living in the basement with the ironing board. Like, people didn't used to think that everything had to be set up perfectly before they had children.
And you're just you're swapping the time when it's going to be a financial struggle. We did not wait because of money, actually. We really, mm-hmm. Waited just because it just seemed early. People weren't doing it. It just didn't seem, there was no pressing, but nothing was pressing us to do it. But I do think financially, yeah, sure, it would have been, I guess we were making less then than we are now, but we're making more now. We're spent. I mean, you know, I think either when you have your kids, then you don't have any money. And I'm not sure.
Right.
I'm speaking from like a very privileged position to say that then you'd make it work. But I guess I would have rather, in hindsight, I would have rather struggled in my 20s than, like, you know, knowing that we won't even be able to think about possibly having a home with a second bathroom, as I write in my piece, until we're in our mid-40s.
Right, but you would have felt socially isolated. Like, I assume that's probably one of the reasons.
I don't think we would have. I mean, that was a fear of mine, I think, but mm-hmm. I don't think that that's true. We would have met people. They would have been older than us, but I don't think we would have.
Wait, how old were you when you had your first child?
I wasn't that old. I was 31.
Uh-huh. That's not old.
That strikes me as the earliest. Like, my first friend just had a baby. Jess Gross, actually, is my first friend to have a child, and she's 30, and I think she's among the first of her friends as well.
Yes, I was 30, and that was the first among my friends.
And that's New York City, that's Washington, D.C., that's a specific subset, but still.
I just thought This is 40, which I won't say anything about more than this, but in the movie, you know, they're both turning 40, and their kids are preteens and teenagers, and I'm just, you know, that sounds nice.
Yeah. So I had several male friends who read this article and came up and freaked out in a way that they hadn't been freaking out about this before. Did any of your unmarried or, you know?
I'm so glad to hear that, because that's actually the thing I loved about this article. And I thought Judith did a pretty good job, although she wasn't completely explicit about this, that this is not – we think of this entirely as a question of feminism and women's fertility choices. And I think the more this becomes a universal question of fertility choices, the more research that's done on the disintegration of sperm. Like, I love that particular detail from this British researcher that thing about men taking hot baths and tight underwear turns out to be true. that does affect your sperm count. And then also that great study that came in that's a terrible way to put it. I sound all wrong when I'm talking about this, because this was a study about older fathers and schizophrenia, and that, you know, astronomically higher percentage you have of having a child with schizophrenia if you're an older father. I think the more this becomes the kind of universal problem of older parents, then, you know, you can't just have women feeling the urgency to have children and get married. If none of the men around them feel that urgency, then, like, it's, you know, what's going to happen? 22-year-olds are going to marry 40-year-old dudes? Like, how's it actually going to come together? So you
need
everybody.
And this really feels new this year. I mean, that once the study that you just referred to, like that major study that got a lot of attention about autism, schizophrenia, like that felt like sort of the first real time that people were not just putting, you know, the burden can't just be on the woman.
Right. And I hadn't realized how much lifestyle factored into that, you know, if a guy drinks or a guy smokes for years and years, that, I mean, it's totally intuitive, you know, you want to be healthy. But that was the most shocking thing to me, I think. And maybe a year or so ago, there was a great article in New York about a man who was a, you know, 35-year-old virgin, but he'd fathered so many children through artificial insemination, and he had basically made his body a temple. He had never had a drink in his life. He had never smoked anything. Wow. And all of these women wanted his, like, extremely pure sperm.
How horrible.
Yeah, that's really, horrible, really like. Weird. That is so weird. Yes, that's, I mean, and it's not just like intuition, right? She writes about the growing study of epigenetics, this idea that molecules latch onto genes, and that even though there's a lot of sociological research showing that older parents are richer and smarter, this growing field of epigenetics also takes into account the fact that they've had a longer time to ingest toxins and smoke and drink and sort of do all those things, which I know Judith has written about before. So I think, you know, the more explicit we get about the medicalization of older, like, we really need some hard data, right? Because otherwise you'll end up, I mean, the article that should never be able to be written again is the one that ran in the New York Times. I think it was 2 years ago. Jess Gross made brutal fun of it at the time, about women in their 40s who were shocked to learn from infertility doctors that they were largely infertile,
right,
because they looked so good. Like, I'm slender,
right.
I do Pilates, I go to the gym, I have healthy skin, I eat organic food, so, you know, what the fuck, basically? How is it possible? And to be frank, I have a friend who actually just went through this. And it's, you know, we made fun of it, but it was quite tragic when it happened to someone close to me. And that trick of the mind is something it's very hard to avoid, saying, like, I'm cute, I'm healthy, like, what's the problem?
Well, you know? It's also all part of this, like, never-ending, having-it-all debate that won't end, and we'll go into 2013. But, you know, yeah, we're sort of all – well, I think in the truth, none of us actually think this, but there's this sort of more general sense that we can put these things off, that we can focus on our career, that feminism has allowed us all these choices, which it has. And right, that when we're 45 and we walk into the doctor's office and we're, you know, our arms are really toned, we'll be fine.
Right. I wonder if there's any, I mean, I asked this before. You know, she concludes by saying, very simply, people just need to procreate earlier. She quotes a doctor saying that that's a solution.
Right.
And it's like, is that possible? Like, we keep talking about women focusing on their careers. You know, is this a case of people being excessively grown up when they come out of college and excessively kind of focused and career oriented? Or is it a case of people feeling very young when they come out of college and are infantilized and don't feel even remotely ready to be grown-ups?
I think it's the latter.
Why do you think
that? But it's not true, right? I mean, I think you're right, Noreen. The whole, like, delayed adolescence thing is real. But if you got pregnant and had a – I mean, depending on the circumstances, but – I don't think our parents felt that old when they were 22 either. Like, I think people just figured it out. And I don't see why we recoil so much from the solution to this being to have kids younger. Why is that such a horrible thing if you know?
I don't think it's a horrible thing, but I also just think people don't maybe crave children that, you know, and if you don't have to have – if you can have 10 years of fucking around and being, like, completely at your own leisure and – so you're 32 when you have a kid, that doesn't seem so bad. And I think that's a scenario everyone's imagining. And then, you know, what happens is that 32 happens to be the time when your career is taking off, or you, like, just break up with whomever then. It's complicated, but I think I still side with the anti-Judith camp. Even having having heard all of her arguments, buying them all, I still still want to have it all, guys.
Yeah. I think it's a deep identity question. I think it's what you say and a little bit more, because it is, there's big socioeconomic differences, right? So poorer women actually do crave children, and it is a big part of their identity. And they actually think, Catherine Eden, who's done wonderful studies of women, women in poor Philadelphia, they think there's something wrong with you as a young woman if you don't have children. Like, somehow you're just not a young woman. Like, it's not that they accidentally, you know, she basically busts through this myth that women just, like, end up getting pregnant because they don't understand how to use birth control, and argues that it's not like that at all. It's like a very central part of what it means to them to go through life and to become a woman, and it really happens simultaneously with a career. So it's a very different sense of identity than we have, which is, like, having a baby is just weird and anomalous and gets in your way. It's like that is something feminism has to own, that it's removed the sense that, you know, baby making is a normal part of your
20s. And that's its own sort of suffocation. I mean, that's
It's what do you mean?
That I think that's so pervasive among, you know, sort of upper middle class, coastal or urban women, that, like, if you know someone who's having a baby when they're 24, you think they must be, like, crazy Catholic or something.
Right.
I think that,
right,
you know, that in itself, like, sort of almost takes the possibility out of the decision making, you know, when you're, it's not even there. It's not, warm up to the idea.
Tracy Egan's piece, which I was reading right before this podcast on Jezebel, which is this insane rant against other people's children. And the premise of it is very funny. It's like, when I had my own first child, I thought that I would come to love children more generally. But in fact, like, it's incredibly, like, vile and profane, but it's all about how much she can't stand other people's children. And I thought it was crazy, actually, but more what I thought is, you know, even when she has a child making doesn't feel right to her. Like, she won't settle into that role. She doesn't appreciate the children. She doesn't like children. It's just like she has her own particular experience, but it doesn't universalize into anything else.
Right. And I think it's very much her own particular experience. I think I find that study that you just mentioned fascinating, because I think that actually does happen. Like, the same sort of feeling kicks in where you're not actually, like, a real woman until you have a kid, but it just kicks in 10 years later for women in a different – which is exactly what we're talking about, the fact that it kicks in slightly too late.
I also think it's a thing that's, like, has always been where, is, you know, I don't feel like a grown-up. I still don't feel like a grown-up. I'm going to be 40. I'm not like my mother was when she was 40. Well, my mom felt the same way. My mom still, you know, had, like, weird – body confusion where she'd see, like, young people on the street and think they were the same age as her, you know. I mean, I don't think that stuff is new. Like, I don't think any of us think of ourselves inside you still feel like the same person you were when you were 12. And so I think, like, this notion that, like, that we take longer to grow up or finally at 35 feel ready, I don't know.
So here's the final question on this. You know that video of that couple who broke up that I blogged about, where she said she didn't want to have kids and he said he did want to have kids? So what if, Noreen, you're wrong, and it's not that people start feeling this later and later, but that we somehow managed to stop feeling it, like that we stop having the maternal feeling? Like, it is true that in industrialized countries and in the U.S., you know, the birth rates are dropping. Of course, Ross Douthat wrote about that. I don't think this is a moral question. It just happens to be a fact. But is it possible to eliminate the maternal instinct? I mean, certainly many more women are doing it more explicitly, like, I don't want to have kids. I mean, that song says it pretty straightforwardly.
Well, that presupposes that everyone has it to begin with, and that for some people it's not just a social construct that's been layered on top, right? I think, you know, maybe not everyone has had it to begin with.
Right.
I guess is what I'm saying. But yeah, sure. I think, you know, if you're living in a very, very different environment than the one that maybe has been the environment for centuries, then of course you're going to react in a different way when it comes to a big life decision like having a child, which will be with you for the rest of your life, you know?
And it's possible. I mean, certainly literature and memoirs tell us so, that there's some percentage of women who don't want kids and never did want kids, mm-hmm. but that it was so socially unacceptable they felt they had to have them, you mm-hmm. know? And in years past, you would just, like, stick them with your aunt and go off on a boat to Europe, and now you just don't, you know, you save the child that heartache. Okay, let's move on to our second topic, which is gender neutral toys. But before we do that, let's talk about our sponsor. Loyal listeners of the Double X podcast know that our sponsor is Audible.com, the largest purveyor of digital spoken audio information and entertainment on the internet. You can listen to more than 100,000 audiobooks on any device, including the one you're listening to us on right now. And you can sign up for a 30-day free trial at our special URL, which is audiblepodcast.com/XX, not double X, but XX. I'm going to recommend just in the spirit of opposing Judith Shulevitz's article, Tina Fey's Bossy Pants, you know, sort of the kick-ass take on what it is to be a woman having a baby at 40, which is one of Tina Fey's hilarious subjects. And she reads the book herself on Audible. So it's very funny. Okay, let's move on to gender-neutral toys. We have the Swedes to thank for this topic. The Swedish equivalent of the Better Business Bureau has convinced their major toy distributor in the country that they have been portraying dolls in their holiday catalog in an outdated way. So in the new 2012 catalog, they show a picture of a girl shooting a Nerf gun, a boy caressing a baby doll, and all sorts of gender-scrambling notions. At the same time, there's been a proliferation of more gender-neutral toys in the U.S. Firehouses that look suspiciously like dollhouses, a Barbie construction set. A 13-year-old girl recently petitioned Hasbro about its easy bake ovens, which she said were packaged unnecessarily in pink and purple. So is this stupid social engineering? Do we care about it? Should we care about it? I wrote about this week, and I decided that we really, really have to care about these gender-neutral toys. So, Noreen, when you looked at the picture of the girl shooting the Nerf gun or the boy kissing on the baby doll, did you find it just weird or convincing, or how did it strike you?
No, I think it's fine. What I am wondering is, what exactly does gender neutral mean in this context? Because it seems to me like these toys are actually like, you know, the Barbie construction set is more like a construction set in drag than anything neutral, you know? Like, it's highly gendered. Like, they're saying, no, it's okay for girls to be construction workers too, when in fact, if it were actually neutral, it just wouldn't be painted pink, or it wouldn't be painted, you know, what's the boy color, red or green or whatever.
That's a really good point, because toys used to be like that. Like, if you had hula hoops, they weren't explicitly, I mean, it might possibly be that more girls used hula hoops or more boys used Rubik's Cubes, but if I'm thinking of the classic toys of the last, you know, century or half century, they're fairly neutral. They're like,
yeah. And so it's, I don't have kids, but I have two little nephews who come over to play at my parents' house all the time. And my parents have all these old toys from the 70s and 80s that are much more actually gender neutral than what you find today, and the kids love them.
Like
they'll play with our little girl toys, which actually, you know, are Playmobil sets that aren't pink, you know, they're just regular colored. And it really strikes me as a phenomenon of the last, you know, 25 years, let's say.
Do we know what started that?
Marketing?
Yes, yeah. I do. I actually was reading a lot about toys for another story I'm writing. So it was just the commercialization of toys. So until the 70s, basically there were classic toys, and the whole conception of what a toy was very different. So toys were not designed to create a separate world that only children inhabited, which adults were, you know, probably by necessity hostile to. Basically, toys were designed almost in that Montessori fashion as preparations for adulthood. Mm-hmm. So you would learn to build, or you would learn to use a garage station, or you might have a doll, you know, but it was like, we're preparing you to be a big person. Play was like becoming an adult. Whereas because of commercialization and after the 70s and branding and marketing, there came to be this sense that children had to have their own cordoned off special world of toys, which were tied into the TV shows that they watched. And then parents were sort of hostile to that. And, you know, toys became highly gendered because niche markets sell better. Like, it's easier for the toy marketers to imagine, like, you know, pink this, a pink princess, and blue truck, and thus develop this whole construction of gender around that.
And because, as you wrote in your piece on Slate, it is actually true to a remarkable degree that little boys are drawn to little boy toys, and I see that in my nephews all the time. Their parents have not steered them toward Transformers and, you know, whatever else they're into at the moment, you know, dinosaurs, but they have just independently come to that, which is incredibly fascinating to me.
You know? But you say in your piece, I mean, I definitely find that with my 4-year-old, but you say in your piece that basically this is just a phase to push through, that it's not like if we give over to that, then then sure, we can see that as like some, you know, as truth. But really, it's just like a preschool phase.
Yeah, it's incredibly anomalous. I mean, it's funny. The research in many, many countries, as I write in this piece and, you know, across social classes, all repeats this fact that play for very young children is very gender specific. That, you know, many studies have confirmed that. On the other hand, it's one of the biggest gender differences that we can point out. There are no other cognitive or personality differences that are as starkly divided as play in very young children. So to take it as something typical, in other words, to then conclude, oh yes, boys and girls must be very different, which I think parents do. I mean, it's kind of weird for parents, especially progressive parents who have lived their whole life thinking that, you know, boys and girls are reasonably similar, to suddenly have these children who, you know, a boy who will only play with trucks, or the girls who suddenly want to dress up like princesses, and you think, you know, a natural thought is, oh my God, I've been wrong all this time. In fact, boys and girls are incredibly different, and look at it in my child. But that's not really a reasonable conclusion from what you see in your toddler, because toddlers are very kind of literal minded and they're starkly trying to define themselves. And that's the place in which they are just the most divided. So it's actually not that meaningful. It's just kind of a phase that they're going through. And it's also fairly arbitrary. I mean, if you take something like Pink and Blue, which many people have written about it, they were reversed, Pink and Blue. At the beginning part of the century, blue was for girls and pink was for boys. And there was some arbitrary department store decision that was made. We ran a slideshow about this once called The Unusual Uses of Pink and Slate. And, you know, department stores just kind of arbitrarily made a decision that pink was going to be for girls so that they could have a girl section in the department store. So it's fairly arbitrary. They just kind of latch on to these identities, and it's not that meaningful.
We also feed into it in some way, right, as parents, because depending on what gender child we have, because with boys, generally we don't mind. I mean, I guess like a lot of progressive parents don't want their kids playing with guns or other fighting tools, although they can do that with sticks or whatever. But with boys, we don't seem to mind that they're obsessed with trucks. It's really the loathing is about the girls with the princess stuff and the pink stuff. And so if we are okay with it with boys, then we kind of perpetuate, at least on this one side, that it goes that way. Which then I would think would push the other side in the other direction.
So is it so damaging? Like, I've thought about this a lot. Like, if it is really just a phase and you're trying on, you're saying to yourself, I'm a girl, this is what girls wear, why is that so bad?
It's not. Yeah. It's actually not a big deal. I like the Swedish toy catalogs because it's kind of a reminder to the parents. It's such a jarring image that you're looking at this image and you're thinking, oh, this is totally weird. So it makes you sort of think the whole thing is less real than it is. It's like makes it look like an illusion almost, which it is an illusion. I don't think it's such a big deal. I mean, I don't know many girls whose princess phase lasted very long. Right. Like it comes and it's gone. It's like makes absolutely no difference. I have, you know, little stickers now that are left because I've pulled out the toddler toys because I have this toddler, and occasionally I'll find like a little princess sticker on the potty or under a chair, which my daughter put there. But like, God, I don't even remember her princess phase. She couldn't be so, she's so not a princess now. Yeah. It just comes and goes. But Allison, what you said about girls and princesses is interesting to me. That's, of course, Peggy Orenstein's book about, you know, how Disney has colonized her daughters. But how would you, if your sons, this is honest answer now, if one of your sons was really into dolls, would you be alarmed?
I don't know if I'd be alarmed, but I would, being honest, I probably would like it would, I would notice it. I would think about it. I mean, I reviewed a book for Slate maybe 2 months ago by John Schwartz, a writer for the New York Times, about his son who was gay and attempted suicide, and it's all about sort of their family journey. But he started suspecting that his son was gay when his son was playing with dolls at, you know, 2 and 3 years old. And you think, as like a progressive parent, well, how silly of you to think that? How close-minded of you to think that? And it turned out, you know, to be true. I don't care if my son turns out to be gay. He didn't care if his son turned out to be gay. But I think that, you know, I am not... I think that if my son wanted to play with Barbies and dress up in princess dresses all the time, I would probably somehow react negatively to that.
Yeah, you would think of it as worrisome. I mean, one of the most interesting things that comes up in the research, and I talk about a lot of caveats in my piece to the to the gender toy research, is that girls diversify in the mid-preschool years. They start to play with lots of other toys pretty naturally, and boys don't. Boys become more closed in their toy preferences. And I think that has to be socialization. I mean, it has to be that boys pay a higher price for whatever reason for playing with girl toys.
Well, we make it much harder on boys. I mean, girls are cool if they like punk rock and they, you know, and they're
exactly
a little bit tomboyish, and boys are sissies.
Right, exactly. And I think that's still true. That, you know, and there's a great study that was done, which I mentioned, which is a kid peer pressure study where they had boys and girls come play, and in half the experiment they put another child in the room, and whenever they had another child in the room, the boys were much less likely to experiment with girl toys than when there wasn't another child in the room. So, you know, peer pressure can be a powerful thing when kids are very, very young.
Isn't it also just number of options? Like, there's so many more options for boy toys, right? Like, what are the things that we think of as specifically feminine, and like dolls, you know,
kitchens.
There aren't that many things. There's a much wider range of things we would file under boy toys. So maybe there's more room for them to sort of play around with their personality within that.
Well, one of the interesting things in the research now is the question of how to classify balls. So in the last sort of 40 years of research, balls have been classified as boy toys. But now, like, but then people ask, like, why is that a boy toy? Like, especially, I mean, one thing I write about in this piece is that our standards have actually changed. So this girl who complained about the Easy Bake Oven, it's ridiculous to say that baking is for girls now, right? Like, if you think of the chefs and where top chefs have gone and all the famous chefs, so many of them are men. And so it's not really a girl thing anymore.
Right.
And yet, you know, and yet somehow we classify this in the toy research as a girl thing. So it's a constantly shifting target.
Well, I do wonder how this all shakes out, because our generation, men, you know, were raised by these Free to Be You and Me 70s moms. And they have all, I'm sure they, you know, went through their truck phase. But a lot of these men are now, you know, they cook and they we all co-parent and blah, 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 blah. Stuff we talk about in every podcast. And I'm curious if, like, is that will that be the same, like, or with our kids? Or have we, has now this proliferation of these gender toys, does this make it? I mean, I think it will be the same. I don't think that this makes a difference, but
it might be that in the future, the toddler extreme gender phase is more a flash in the pan. Like, if you continue, this Firehouse Dollhouse toy was a real revelation to me, because
I have
always wondered why, you know, my son is a total car obsessive. Like, he only has these squat little garages, but it's clear to me that, like, he wants to tell stories, right? Like, he wants the man to go up to the garage and sometimes take a nap, but there's, like, no place to do that in the typical boy toys. So I love this firehouse, because, like, it did have the firehouse pole and it had the cars around, but it also had lots of people and it sort of looked like a dollhouse. And I thought, oh, that's the perfect toy for him. In fact, I may actually buy that toy now.
Yeah,
it's a very cool toy. So, you know, and same is true for the Barbie construction set, because when I was a kid, I mean, the big traumatic thing in my childhood was when my parents, like, finally saved up all the money to buy me a Barbie dollhouse. And I went through a brief Barbie phase and my brother shot it up with his BB gun. He used his target practice.
Amazing story.
Yeah, it's a great story. And actually, as payback to me, what my parents made him do, because my brother's a total tech head and he's still a mechanic, was install an engine in my Barbie car. And so he made it into a remote control car, and that's how, you know, that's what I got back from that.
But I didn't react to that Barbie, you know, building set in the same way that I reacted to that cool firehouse dollhouse, because the Barbie building set was pink, which turned me off.
Right. It is very pink.
But I don't know why it turns me off. I mean, who cares? It's pink. I don't really understand my reaction to that color.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on to our third topic, which is, will you marry me? The marriage proposal remains the holy grail of feminism. Perhaps unsurprisingly, researchers at UC Santa Cruz, when they looked at 200 students and asked them about the theoretical marriage proposal, this is what they found. 2/3 of the students, both male and female, said they definitely want the man to propose marriage. Only 2.8% of women said they'd kind of want to propose, and not a single man indicated he'd prefer that arrangement, and not a single student, male or female, definitely wanted the woman to propose. God, I hate this. I don't understand why this happens. And the thing is, it's UC Santa Cruz, which, you know, UC Santa Cruz is like a hippie school.
Yeah.
So what the hell? Why is this the thing that women can't do? You know, women pay for dates, like, women do all sorts of things, but they just won't ask men to marry them. So why?
I have a question before we get into the why. Why is the marriage proposal power structure seen in the way that it's like that the men hold the power? The men are asking the women, and then the women have the decision to make. Don't they hold the power in that?
Yeah, totally.
Oh, this is good. Okay, totally. I hadn't thought of this. I don't know why I didn't think of this, but go ahead. Explain this to me a little more, one of you.
Nothing else to explain. That's just, I mean,
yeah.
I've always, you know, I could see how we want both to be able to do both and it shouldn't matter and blah, but at the same time, like, it is like the man asking for something and the woman deciding. So I don't see why that rubs us the wrong way.
And also, one thing that this kind of doesn't take into account is that I think a lot of people just sort of talk about marriage a lot before that the actual asking is a formality. It's more about, like, what is the occasion? What's the story we're going to have to tell? What are the pictures we're going to have to put on Facebook? What's the setting? More than it is the actual decision being made in that moment, you know?
But if you have a friend who tells you that she asked a guy to marry her, what comes to your mind about this woman? You think she's desperate?
Not desperate.
So what? I mean, I really can't figure out why it's so transgressive.
I think it depends on how you've seen their relationship thus far. Like, if it's always been, like, you know, the couple who, like, you think the guy's always been had a Peter Pan complex. They're always wanting to get out, and she's, you know, it just depends on how you, but likely, like as Noreen said, they've been living together for 5 years, and you knew that this was going to happen. If you think you have a good relationship, if you think they have a strong relationship, then I don't know. I don't think it would rub me the wrong way at all.
Well, I'm going to say something that people will definitely get mad at me for because it's extremely anti-feminist, but sort of, you know, wisdom that people say after 4 drinks is that the best relationship is the one in which the man is more into it than the woman. Like, that's the one that lasts, which I'm not weighing in on whether that's true or not. But I think there is that sort of feeling that, you know, if he's the one doing the asking, you're not sort of forcing him into anything and you're not, you know, marching him down the aisle when he doesn't want to go. He really wants it, you know, and that's some people think that's a stronger template for.
Well, that's what Amanda Marcotte wrote about in her blog post. She said, you know, it's not about changing the marriage proposals. It's about changing the way we think of roles in relationships, that we are constant, that we're like sort of programmed to think that the women are the one who kind of are always ready for the commitment and are always trying to rope the guy in. The guy's always the one who's a little bit commitment phobic, who always wants to run. And maybe that's not the case.
Yeah, but Noreen's saying that is the case. Noreen is saying that not that she is going against this wisdom, but that the wisdom is true, right, Noreen? That it is true, in fact, that the best relationships are one where the man is more into it than the woman. And in fact, underlying that is exactly what Amanda Marcotte says is annoying.
Right, sure. It's totally annoying, but that doesn't mean that it's not the framework under which we are often operating, you know?
Right.
But is it factual?
Yeah, I don't know if it's factual. Actually, you find in study after study that men fall in love more quickly and men know that they want to get married more quickly and that they know they want kids. You know, men are just more romantic, and they seem to find. So I'm not sure it's entirely true, but I think there is a perception that you have to, you know, have this certain dynamic.
So in this Helen Fisher study of Match.com, she's an anthropologist and she teams up with Match.com to survey people who are in the dating market. And she generally surveys people between the ages of 21 and 34. She does find surprising similarity between men and women. And men, it's not so much that men are more romantic. The upshot of her research generally shows that men are commitment-minded, like more traditional or something, that they're not running away from conventions. They don't necessarily want their personal space. In her latest survey, which is the one for 2012, she found that men wanted children more than women wanted mm-hmm. children, or were more straightforwardly saying that they wanted children. So maybe it's that once men have the right match, then they're ready for it. I don't really know how to think about this. I actually do think it's a problem that women don't ask men to marry them.
I'm so not bugged by it.
I'm not bugged
by
it either. I mean, why are you – is tradition bad always? Is tradition always – I mean
– No, tradition's not always bad. It's just when there are certain things that one gender or another really can't do. You know, and I feel this way about men too, that there are certain things that are so – off limits to young boys that are considered completely unmanly. And I think it's considered still pretty unfeminine. You know, the same way I'm bothered by our judgment of women who don't want to have children, I'm bothered by our judgment of women who can't ask men to marry them. Not that I think it should be 50-50 or that all men, you know, all women should always ask the men to marry them, but I just don't think it should be so completely transgressive that zero students, you know, were enthusiastic about the idea of a woman asking a man to marry her.
Well, and but Hannah, I'm going to quote you back at you. In your book, you sort of write about what parts of chivalry last when
right.
the economic power goes away. So I actually have real problems with an engagement ring and that sort of traditional part of
– Why?
The usual communist reasons, you know.
Uh-huh.
but this is divorced from money. This is – it's just an old-fashioned
– Uh-huh.
I think basically unharmful,
right?
You know, part of the formalization of love, right? And I have no problem with that.
Right.
I'm okay with keeping that part of it.
That's interesting. So maybe in a world in which so many roles are changing and the roles of men and women are changing and what women are allowed to do are changing, that we really are better off just preserving certain things, like certain images of men, certain images of women. And because the marriage proposal is fairly innocuous, because most people these days, I actually forbid. I had a rule when I was dating David that we would not talk about whether we were getting married or not. Just
good.
As I had a rule that we would not live together. I know this makes me like a weirdo ancient dinosaur, but those were just my two rules. But because most people talk about marriage anyway, that it's just not that big a deal.
Did you want him to propose to you though?
No, I didn't care. I just didn't want to have like endless conversations about are we going to get married. I found that very anti-romantic,
yeah.
Just like I found living together kind of anti-romantic. Is that – you think that's really old-fashioned? That's just how I felt at the time. I didn't really have a complete philosophy about it. I just didn't want to do it.
I've actually heard from – I don't know who told me this, but that David also feels strongly about that living together is not a good idea.
Yeah, but he's totally moralistic and I'm not. Like I just found it unfun. Like he has like philosophy is behind it. I don't really have any morality or philosophy. I just didn't get why it was fun to like have to share the bill. It seemed to me like that's something you do when you're a grown up, and like why with the person I was having fun with I would want to like talk about the electricity bill. I just that didn't sound appealing to me at all.
What do you think about men asking my husband actually he did not ask for permission, but I believe he asked for my parents' blessing to marry me? What do you think about that?
You know, I'm completely – Noreen has totally convinced me, and I actually now I think it's cute. Like I've decided that like if we're going to destroy the patriarchy, we can leave them their little
yeah.
cosmetic
yeah.
moments,
yeah.
you know? Like let the man talk to the father. And because of course we know – I mean it's not Afghanistan, right? It doesn't actually matter. Like
right.
if my dad said, no, I hate you, like it wouldn't make any difference.
Right. My brother-in-law, the parents said of his wife said no.
And they're still married.
And
so
they're
it
still married.
Nice way of being like, I'm going to be part of your family.
Right.
You know, ideally, maybe they would talk to the mother and the father. I don't know.
He did. He talked to both. I liked it. I mean, you know, I wouldn't have cared one way or the other, but it certainly didn't make me feel submissive in some
now,
way.
Now, did you guys watch last week's Nashville? I don't want to spoil it for people who didn't, but it ended on a woman character proposing to a man. And so we'll have to tune in this week to see how that works out for her. But she is portrayed in the show as being an extremely aggressive,
right.
grasping, like, you know, grab for the brass ring kind of girl.
Right, right, right.
Also, you know, one of the pieces, maybe the Jezebel piece about this proposal thing, it lumps together the idea of us giving up our names or keeping our own names with the proposal question. I don't see those two things as similar actually at all, other
I think
than they're both about marriage.
Yeah, those are so different. That's a question of giving up your own identity versus,
right.
you know.
This makes me think that one day we have to have a sort of roundup or debate about the traditions we'd like to preserve, like what we don't want to upend, you know?
Maybe we should do that next week.
Yeah, that would be a good conversation. Okay, let's move on to our recommendations. Noreen, why don't you go first?
Okay, so back to Mommyville. I on Saturday, I had a very lazy single person day where I had zero obligations and I didn't feel like leaving the house. So I sat there and read an entire novel in one sitting.
Wow.
And it was Prospect Park West. Have you guys read this? It's mm-hmm.
Amy
Soane. Yeah, it's sort of a beach read, but it's also a real dystopian novel about being a mother in Brownstone, Brooklyn, and places like it. And I couldn't stop turning the pages, and I was absolutely appalled by it. So appalled in a way that she wants you to be. It's a satire. Anyway, it's a good read. It's a fun read, and It questions whether there is such a thing as maternal instinct, I think.
Yeah, it made me not want to move to Brooklyn, basically.
It's not really like that.
I know, but still.
Come on.
I am going to recommend a wonderful piece from the New Yorker Food Issue, which I only got around to reading this week, which is that piece Breadwinner, which is about the old French bakery Poilin and their daughter. She's the amazing one in the story, is why I loved it. Apollonia, which is such a good name. But she was in Harvard. I think, was she a freshman or a sophomore when her parents died in a helicopter crash and she took over as CEO? And it's just an unbelievable portrait of a young woman of a kind that seemed very un-American to me. Like, it wasn't about her personal ambition or anything she had to prove. She kind of literally viewed herself as a historical figure. Like, at one point the writer says, you know, she's not a memoirist, she's a historian. You know, like, she viewed everything in terms of sort of larger forces, which was very European, but it's nonetheless, it's an amazing portrait of this young woman. Allison.
I'm also going to recommend an old New Yorker story, maybe just 2 weeks old, by Rachel Aviv about gay homeless teens in New York City. It's just a really well-reported, not at all kind of tear-jerking piece, but it's quite moving in its details.
The end. I think the end made me cry, actually.
But it's written in a way that you don't feel manipulated into
right,
that
not
at all.
All.
It's a very direct and straightforward piece about, you know, kind of probably a similar culture exists in every big city. And it's, you know, it's hard. It's hard to read.
Well, that is all for today. Thank you to Chris Wade for engineering this podcast. Thank you to Ginny Choi for doing the research for us. Thank you to Andy Bowers, who's the executive producer of All the Slate podcast. As always, please go onto our XX Facebook page if you have recommendations of what you would like us to talk about. For Noreen Malone and Allison Benedict, I'm Hannah Rosen, signing off for this week.